The way Europeans were looking at the world had changed between the Istanbul earthquake and the Lisbon one. The Enlightenment was thriving. So today we want to emphasize that the Enlightenment was not all highfalutin calculations of the sun's orbit or theories about the mathematical laws of the universe, or for that matter, theories about earthquake causality. It also considered much more down-to-earth situations, like how people of different social classes should relate to one another, how trade and manufacturing should function, and what the relationship of ordinary people should be to their government. The Enlightenment, or Age of Light, refers to the belief that the musty old ideas needed to be exposed to the light of rational investigation to see if they were still valuable. The bright light of reason needed to shine on tradition. And this momentous challenge to tradition came about during a time in which Europe was being completely transformed in many ways that are sometimes forgotten amid all the excitement about Voltaire and reason. Increasing abundance and novelty was creeping into the everyday lives of Europeans. Coffee, tea, chocolate, tobacco, and other commodities led to experimentation. For instance, one English housewife saw tea for the first time and thought it was meant to be baked as a kind of pie filling. A diplomat said that tea and coffee had brought a greater sobriety and civility to everyday life in Europe. Europe had previously been a land of famine and mere subsistence for essentially all of its history, but now the cultivation of new foods from the Americas, like potatoes and corn, along with literally thousands of other new plants, meant that available calories were increasing, and it also introduced the idea that maybe the world didn't have to be perpetually on the brink of starvation and catastrophe. Also, by this time, tens of thousands of Europeans had traveled the world and had experienced other social orders firsthand. For instance, travelers discovered that people across Asia didn't seem as quarrelsome as Europeans. Drivers of carts didn't block narrow streets for hours arguing over who had the right of way. They politely agreed to let one or the other pass. They also saw that not all social orders were as hierarchical as most European ones, and that some societies even gave less weight to a person's parentage and more to a person's individual skills and talents. So one of the first ways writers criticized outmoded ways of life was to make fun of them. Writers like Charles-Louis de Secondat, Baron de la Brède et de Montesquieu, aka just Montesquieu. He really was the proper person to criticize outmoded ways of life, because boy did he have an outmoded name. Montesquieu was a jurist who owned an estate near Bordeaux, which by the way still makes wine under his name, and in 1721 he published the Persian Letters, in which Uzbek visitors find Europe amusing, if not shocking. The visitors, for instance, are amazed at the magic of priests who somehow perform the trick of turning wine into blood. And although they clearly see the problems in French society, they also firmly adhere to the mustiness of their old ways, such as keeping women secluded in a harem guarded by eunuchs. The message was that both Easterners and Europeans were imperfect. The author Voltaire, he had similarly critical and amusing takes. His discourtesy to aristocrats eventually got him sent to the Bastille prison, in fact. In many rollicking tales, Voltaire made fun of overweening rulers and their endless corruptions. He valued honesty and those who lived simple lives, cultivating their gardens, as he famously put it in his satirical novel Candide. Full of horrors and injustice, Candide appeared 4 years after the Lisbon earthquake, which Voltaire thought was firm evidence that we did not live in the best of all possible worlds. To replace the old stuffy ways of monarchs and priests and aristocrats telling us that we were already living in a perfect world, people needed to learn how to embrace the newly desirable traits of the Enlightenment, like being honest and inquisitive and open. Swiss thinker Jean-Jacques Rousseau had many ideas about education reform, for instance. He wasn't a wealthy or titled person, but rather was born into a watchmaking family and lived among artisans. His best-selling novel Emile describes a boy who grows up not in a city or a palace, but in a countryside where one can be oneself. A natural individual. Instead of experiencing common rote learning with large doses of religious and classical reading, Emile learns carpentry and gardening and other practical skills. In the countryside, he behaves in what Rousseau saw as the best possible way, naturally and without pretentious airs. Rousseau promoted what would come to be called middle-class values, like hard work, practicality, and domesticity for women. When Emil becomes a young man, the spouse chosen for him is plump and smiling and devoted to taking care of him, not studying or reading or practicing a craft or working hard to support the family like farm women did. Also, she will breastfeed their children, whereas both aristocratic women and busy working women at the time commonly used wet nurses. And as with Emil's upbringing, all of this is presented as natural. Meanwhile, wealthy women in Europe instituted the Enlightenment Salon, regular get-togethers in their homes to hear the latest idea, learn about the latest book, or meet the latest philosopher influencer, called a philosophe in French. 18th century salon goers were often great readers and also experimenters with the latest commodities and fashion. And instead of looking to the courts for fashion inspiration, men like Voltaire now sported cottons from India made into handkerchiefs that were worn around the neck, which would soon metamorphose into the necktie. Transformation was in the air for everyone, not just the elites. Although imported foreign cottons were still illegal in France, for instance, many people now wore them, including servants who received cast-off cotton dresses or shirts that were bright and easy to keep clean. And to help people learn, there were many new texts. Like in France, there was the Encyclopédie, you'll notice my amazing French pronunciation, which provided discussions of topics such as natural rights and the status of women. Its main editor, Denis Diderot, wrote, "All things must be examined, debated, investigated without exception and without regard for anyone's feelings." Diderot favored social and political reform, but the Encyclopédie, you know what, I'm just going to translate it, encyclopedia, also contained technical drawings of machinery, including machinery for mining, and that reflected practical values and also provided a spur to inventiveness and growing prosperity in Europe. In general, Enlightenment aims were more worldly than spiritual. The Scotsman Adam Smith took on the mercantilist theory that global wealth was static and states could only increase their wealth by taking it from others when he rejected ideas about stockpiling gold and refusing entry of goods into one's country, and also remaining a subsistence agricultural economy with serfs. He advocated instead for manufacturing and the division of labor and free trade in a free or laissez-faire market. An individual would work and interact with others in the economy on the basis of their self-interest, and the sum of all self-interests would make for a balanced, harmonious, and prosperous society. Smith is best known today as the father of the free market, free trade, and individualism, thanks to his 1776 book, An Inquiry into the Nature and Causes of the Wealth of Nations. But he also opposed absolutism and urged concern for the overall well-being of society, because in addition to the benefits of laissez-faire economies that he saw, Smith saw the potential harms, so he also argued for healing social policies. Rationality would not prove to be a way out of the human urge to create and marginalize outsiders. But Enlightenment thought was nonetheless transformative, and seeking worldly explanations for inequality and injustice did have significant real-world consequences. I mean, no longer would we see earthquakes merely as acts of God. Enlightenment challenges to the idea that we were already living in the best of all possible worlds would also help us to imagine, and eventually to live in, better worlds, albeit ones that are still profoundly imperfect.